It is Friday. It is Casual Friday. November, what's today? November 5th? Yeah. It's Casual Friday, November 5th, 2010. This is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. The new Neo Majority Report. And it's day three of our soft launch. Got a little harder, the launch. Got a little less soft. A little quicker than we thought it would. A lot of people showing up. Very much appreciated. But we're literally sitting, Evan and I and Dorsey are sitting amongst a bunch of boxes and some sound panels I jerry-rigged. And so we're going to take this Casual Friday to set up our office slash studio closet. And we are going to set it up, trick it out, so that come Monday, we will have a better show. But I am incredibly impressed with our technology. It seems to be working quite well. And we are, as you can see, we stream live here every day at 11:30. And then within an hour, the podcast is up. And it's we'll actually get it down to the point where we can actually do it in about 55 minutes. Maybe somewhere 54, 56, somewhere around 55 minutes. We will have it up, maybe even earlier than that. And next week, we hope to have the capacity to have some guests, and we will get this juggernaut rolling. But in the meantime, we've got to set up the office and buy some chairs, because it's not right that the people working on the show sit on stools and flog themselves because of some weird issue I have. Anyways, so in lieu of a live show today, we've decided to play the first Majority Report ever on Air America, which took place on March 30th. I thought it was April 1st, but it was actually on March 30th, the evening of March 30th. And guests include Bill Maher, Dave Chappelle, I think Atrios, and I think Howard Dean. Now, this is back when people thought Atrios, this is back when people still thought Atrios may be Joe Klein, if you can believe it. There was actually a time when that was the case. And so listen to that, this show, and come back here Monday at 11:30 when we begin to get a little bit closer to our official launch. I don't think that's going to happen for another week, but next week will be a lot tighter. And feel free to comment on the blog at majority.fm. And let us know if you're having any technical issues that we should address, any suggestions, anything you want to donate, like a computer, like a Mac computer. We could use a Mac computer. Or technical expertise. And enjoy. Here it is, the first Majority Report ever, back at a time where I was almost slightly worse at this than I am now.
Majority Report with Janine Garofalo and Sam Cedar. The left has never been so right or so sexy. The Majority Report.
Good evening and welcome to the Majority Report. I'm Janine Garofalo.
And I'm Sam Cedar.
And we are 7 minutes and 39 seconds late. Please don't hold that against us, but it is, as always, Casual Wednesdays here. So I am bedenimed and taking everything 7 minutes behind its normal time.
And you're creaseless.
I
also noticed.
I also can't hear myself in my own headphones. I don't know if that's normal first day stuff, so I'm hoping they...
Janine, which I think will become apparent to our listeners, to you, our listeners, soon, is a bit of a neo-Luddite.
I just realized I had my dial turned down.
Yes.
Completely turned down. So it was that's what we call a technical failure, and some heads are going to roll, people. Heads are going to roll here. I know it's Casual Wednesday.
It's actually the first time Janine has actually been able to turn a dial. Like you, this is that's like new technology for you, dials, right?
Yes, that's more my germ phobia.
You used to just do switches.
Yeah, I don't have my white gloves. But anyway, enough of this chitter-chatter. Let's talk about who's going to be on the the show tonight. We're going to be talking to activist and co-founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. He's also the founder of TrueMajority.org and business leaders for sensible priorities.
Good leadership.
And congeniality. We'll also be talking to Atrios, Uber blogger Atrios. We're going to be talking to funny man Dave Chappelle and also funny man Bill Maher.
Bill Maher.
I didn't say Ben Cohen. I'm sorry. Founder of Ben & Jerry's, Ben Cohen.
And all those other people you said.
Yeah.
Oh, we are so good at this.
This is
almost nauseating.
It is. I do feel nauseous. I don't know if it's a response to me or just the first day jitters. But anyway, you know, I want to start with a little host chat betwixt us here.
Betwixt us?
About something I saw last night after...
And to the audience.
Yeah, and to the audience.
And to everybody. You're supposed to speak like it's a personal conversation we're having.
Yeah, it is. And I was watching Letterman last night, and David Letterman brought up that they had shown on the Letterman show a clip of President Bush speaking at some fundraiser or other, and behind the president was a teenage boy who was so visibly bored that it was very funny. He kept checking his watch and yawning and doing neck stretches and things of that nature.
As teenage boys will.
So the Letterman show showed the clip, and it was very, very funny. And then the next day, CNN showed the clip to share in the giggling. And then right after CNN showed the clip, the anchor came back on and said someone from the White House had phoned and said that the Letterman people had doctored that video. And then David Letterman said that is a bold-faced lie. That is, there was no doctoring of that video footage. And then moments after the CNN person said, the White House person called, they then amended that to say the White House said that the boy actually was there, but it had been doctored to... The video had been doctored to put him behind the president.
That's impressive technology to have for a comedy show.
Cut and paste video comedy clips. But so the point is, did CNN lie about this, or did the White House lie about this?
Well, the end of the story is that Letterman was pissed because it turned out that none of that was true.
Right. And he was peeved. I don't know with FCC decency rules if you can say that, as the people from the United Kingdom would say, intoxicated, pissed. So
no, I was saying it as in angry.
Right. I don't know if we're allowed to say that anymore with the decency rules.
It's an adjective, not a verb.
Okay.
But the point is, I mean, that really is the question. If either the White House told CNN that, it was fake, or CNN just took it upon themselves to say it was fake on behalf of the White House.
Right.
Either way, it's a little bit disturbing. I mean, let's just take scenario one, that the White House lied about it.
Mm-hmm. Didn't they restore morality and character to the White House?
Well, maybe lying about things doesn't necessarily fall into that rubric.
But if God chose George Bush, as George Bush has said, wouldn't God frown on the White House lying?
Or, ergo ipso facto, God is a liar. It's possible. But, I mean, let's look at this. Let's break down the two scenarios. Scenario one, the White House lied to CNN because they're terrified at the prospect of teenagers being bored with the president. I just don't understand the logic of that.
That would mean he wasn't tough on security.
Yes, he wasn't.
It would mean that he rendered teens bored on security.
Sales would drop for the Top Gun flight pattern of George Bush doll.
Which you have.
I have that one. I actually have the one with the suit, and we're going to bring them in and show sort of copulation
scenes.
Dylan,
you have the Rumsfeld doll and the Bush doll.
I got the Rumsfeld doll. I got the talking Rumsfeld doll. I got the talking Bush doll. The one with the flight suit and the big package, as it were, and him in a suit. So he's got both the rugged look and the sort of more presidential look.
You know what my favorite presidential look is the one where he's in Crawford, Texas, in front of that one giant bale of hay. And when it's casual Wednesday, or now he is bedenimed usually.
Right.
It's that same look. Actually, it's a notch more casual than the look of when candidates are out and about with the people, and they wear their khakis, they will wear a pleated front pant, and maybe a Patagonia jacket.
Right.
That's when they're flipping a pancake, talking to John and Jane Q. Public.
Going to McDonald's.
Right.
having a coffee at the diner that they would never otherwise go to.
Right. You know what?
When did he buy that ranch in Crawford? It was right before the election, right?
I would assume so for publicity purposes. I don't know that for sure. And I've also heard that on that ranch, and this may or may not be true, that he's very, very energy conscious. There's solar-powered panels in the home and all kinds of nods to energy conservation and environmental protections that do not exist in his policy.
Yeah, but you know what? I have to say, in his defense, those are not nods to environmental policies. They're nods to survivalists.
Oh, right.
Secret
millennialists.
Yes.
Because the end of days is nigh.
I forgot
about that part of his event, of his charismatic Catholic.
This is where if we had like the full sort of radio rigging, we would hit those bells that would be a bong.
Do you remember when...
Back to the whole scenario where the White House lied to CNN because they're afraid of...
Or CNN took it upon themselves.
Scenario two is CNN took it upon themselves to lie. There actually is a scenario three, but we'll get to that in a second. So why would CNN lie for the president?
I don't know. It would seem remarkable.
It's a rhetorical question because they do it all the time. But there is an option three, just to be fair. And that is that they're so incompetent at their jobs that somebody in the control room or somewhere or like an intern getting a copy goes, I think Letterman, I think he faked that. And they just said, the White House said it.
But I would actually say CNN is the least likely to fabricate things for the president. Now, if you're going to, I'm sure Britt Hume will devote an entire episode to how Letterman doctored the footage.
Janine, get over it.
His Algonquin roundtable of apologists.
Yes, his three-person panel of the extreme right, the far extreme right, and the very, very extreme fascist right.
radical dystopian.
You know what I think about, Britt Hume, now that we're talking about this? I know that we're jumping around, but we have sort of a digital quality to our show,
right,
don't we? I mean, we can go on tangents. Britt Hume now, he finishes it fair and balanced and unafraid. What are we supposed to think that he's afraid of? I mean, what exactly is, he's unafraid to lie? Like, it would just look straight into that camera and lie with no fear, no sense that there's going to be any accountability for anything he says.
Right. Well, he is part of what I like to call the accountability last crowd. You know, that Gene Kirkpatrick famously termed the Blame America First crowd, which means anybody that has any criticism or any dissenting opinions on American foreign policy decisions over the last 50 years is called a Blame America Firster. And I would counter that by saying that what is going on right now is the accountability last crowd, which you can see on Fox a lot.
What is it with conservatives that they do not believe in taking... not just personal responsibility, but public responsibility?
Well, conservatives do. We're not talking about legit conservatives. Legit conservatives do believe in fiscal prudence, small government, personal responsibility. This is not what we're dealing with now in contemporary culture. This is the new metal conservatism, which is the politics of extreme belligerence, elastic ethics, and very malleable and bendable truths, and just always sending out the attack dogs if there's any kind of dissent or criticism.
Did you ever watch Get Smart?
Yes, I did.
Do you remember when they kidnapped Jaime the robot, and then they had a fake Jaime the robot?
Yes.
It's like that's what's happened with the conservatives. There's no real conservatives anymore. I mean, I don't particularly like conservatives, their ideology necessarily, but at least they had one.
No, there are real conservatives. They just don't. They're just not as loud as the professional wrestlers that you see in the new metal conservative posse.
Oh, you mean the profiteerist posse?
The corporate profiteerists and the closet sort of bigot, homophobe, misogynist people that masquerade as Republicans. And they do a real disservice to the Republican Party and to conservatives in general. There's a lot of right-wingers who have a real problem with anyone who's not like them. They have a real problem with the other, if you will. And as we'll get into on other shows, the Martin Buber talks about the I-it relationship that people who are paranoid have with the world. The new metal conservatives have an I-it relationship with the world as opposed to a respectful I-thou relationship.
Well, we've got to take a break. We'll be talking about all this and more as we come back. And our first guest coming up after the break will be Real Time's Bill Maher. And you are listening to The Majority Report.
Welcome Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Janine Garofalo, along with Sam Cedar, and very shortly we're going to be talking to our first guest, Bill Maher, from HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher. And we've got 40 seconds for you to mention this about Ralph Nader. Sam.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if, you know, today was the inaugural day for Air America Radio broadcasting. Our broadcast day started at 12 p.m. this afternoon, but we'll be playing, you know, starting at 6 in the morning after this. So
right, but what the point was, we're going to say that Ralph Nader had phoned into Randy Rhodes and he hung up on her. So, but Bill is on the line, so we'll get back to that story later. Bill, are you with us?
Hi.
Hi, Bill Maher. Thank you so much for being our first guest.
Sure. For you, anything.
Thank
I mean,
you.
For America, anything.
Thank you. This is For America. Thank you. And you're here with myself and Sam.
Hi.
And, Bill, I actually wanted to discuss a number of things. First of all, I know that you're a big religion guy. So I want to know what your take is on the 11th installment of from the Tim LaHaye series of The Left Behind, called The Glorious Appearing.
The Glorious Appearing.
Yeah. So as you know, the end of days is nigh. So how does that figure into things in your social life? Are you trying to get things? Do you have a to-do list before the end of days?
I always love it when they novelize the Bible. You know, I feel it's not really it's the language that stops a lot of people from understanding what's going on. Yeah, and that plus the Mel Gibson movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that?
Yes, which is, again, extending the image of the very punishing God, the very cruel. That's more like a Walking Tall movie to me. They want to get you all riled up to go out and get some Jews for having beaten the crud out of Jesus.
What's on it? And the interesting thing is CBS, I think it was, which had a Jesus movie in their vault that they showed a couple of years ago, re-showed it the other night, but they cut out the first, like, 4 hours of it. It was like a mini-series, and they just showed the ending.
The jumping in violence as
that's
the gang.
The thing. We
jumping
just,
Jesus in.
We just want to see the beating at the end.
Well, it's classic conservatives victimization. The victimization they're trying to sell the rest of the country.
Wow.
Yeah. The victim status, right?
The victim status.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, we had Myrna Blythe in here talking about how liberals are always trying to sell victim status.
Yeah.
Yeah, she wrote that book, Spin Sisters.
Yeah.
How the media sells liberalism, unhappiness, and sort of victim status to the American people.
You butchered the title, but it was definitely
I know,
worth
I couldn't remember. It was Spin Sisters, something, liberalism is bad, something.
But let's not be as bad as they are and make everything about how they're bad, because that's not the truth either. So, I can't quite go along with that theory that this Jesus thing is all about them feeling, the conservatives feeling like they're victims. I mean...
I know, Sam was just joking with you.
Bill, I just like to joke around about Christianity because I'm Jewish.
And I also make a distinction between legit conservatives and new metal conservatives.
What does that mean?
Well, legitimate conservatives who believe in fiscal prudence, small government, personal responsibility, and sort of the new metal conservatism, which is the yelling and screaming and the Sean Hannity and type of Jerry Falwell-ish.
Well, you know, your boy Al Franken, who I guess started kicked this off today, right?
Yes, at noon.
He said the best thing. I quoted him on my show last year, I think, when he said conservatives are like children in that regard with their country. They're children with their mommy, and mommy can do no wrong. That, to me, is the essence of it, is that they just have a very rose-colored view of this country. They have what I call, you know, clueless white girl syndrome. They look at everything like a clueless white girl.
Well, don't lump all white girls in with the...
I said clueless.
Oh, you mean from the movie Clueless.
No, I mean clueless. Like, you know, just clueless.
Well, you know, they have a childlike reverence, some of the right have a childlike daddy syndrome reverence with the memory of Ronald Reagan when he was in office.
Oh, that's the word.
And, you know, the way that the CBS biopic, they got their diapers all in a knot over the Judy Davis, James Brolin biopic.
Right, which was so not anti-Reagan, that movie.
Right, they didn't mention anything about Iran-Contra, as far as I know. And about the allegations that he held the hostages after the hostages be held until after the election.
I thought Brolin did a magnificent job. I thought he really was Reagan. And I thought she was great, too. And it was so not anti-Reagan.
I know. They didn't like that he is with Barbara Streisand. As you know, Barbara Streisand is held by the right as some type of evil scourge for some reason.
She has magical powers, I think.
But this idea, I've had guys on, especially on the old show, who would talk about the fact that we need to put Reagan on currency. We need to put him on Mount Rushmore. And I'm like, could this guy die first before you even consider how inappropriate it is to put somebody? Wasn't that what this country was founded on, that we didn't want the king on the currency?
Well, you know why I think that there is the movement afoot by guys like Grover Norquist and Peggy Newman?
Grover Norquist is one of them, yes.
They want to rename everything, airports, park benches, bidets, after Ronald Reagan, so that future generations just assume he was this fantastic guy. He must have been fantastic. We are in Ronald Reagan Airport. So that's what I feel.
But that to me is that's what Al means when he's talking about that mommy syndrome. Mommy can do no wrong. Reagan is that person for the right. He is, you know, they regard him like, and always did, like some sort of, like a doting parent regards a small child. Everything he does is remarkable. He made a duty. You know, and I don't mean that the police, you know, this is not like making fun of him because he's infirm, I understand that. I'm just saying this went on before he was, while he was president, they were doing this. And this has nothing to do with his illness. They just regard him in a way that is hagiographical. He is a saint. He is not regarded as a person, a politician. He's a demigod. And it is childish. Excuse me. Conservatives, it is childish.
But why do you think they do it? I mean, do you actually think that they do it because they actually feel that way sincerely, or are they just trying to build up some type of, you know, their own FDR?
I think at the bottom of it is nostalgia. I think conservatives, that type of conservative, like Ronald Reagan himself, is nostalgic for an America that is never coming back. Nostalgic for America that, yes, was a better country in the 50s, if you were one of the people for whom the country was better for, if you were not black or Jewish or gay or Hispanic or any of the, you know, or an abused child or any of the other million things that we used to sweep under the rug. Yes, when we stopped sweeping things under the rug, the country got more uncomfortable for more people. It is true. For the white majority, it was more uncomfortable. They had to put up with more. But that's what happens when you include everybody.
Right.
So they're nostalgic for that era when things for them were a lot more neat and easy. But that's the price you pay when you include everybody.
I agree with you, and I think that is a lot of the reason why the 60s are so maligned by the right.
Right.
They cannot stand that attempt to level the playing field. They cannot stand the inclusiveness of the 60s. So you will have right-wingers who are furious with Abbie Hoffman for wearing a flag shirt, but the My Lai Massacre, not so much.
Right.
Not so much anger over that.
People were much better dressed during that. They were much better dressed. All right, well, listen, we've got to take a break. We are talking to Bill Maher from HBO's Real Time and from
we'll
just about
right
everywhere
back
else.
With the Majority Report.
You know, it shows me how clueless this country can be. We raised this week, the Congress did, the bounty on Osama bin Laden from $25 million to $50 million. Because those Afghan goat herders will not get out of bed for less than $40 million.
Air America Radio. The laughingstock of talk radio.
The president is having a little trouble keeping the coalition together. Spain seems to be opting out. The president of Poland, one of our key allies, said this week that he was... That's true. He said, quote, "We were taken for a ride on the weapons of mass destruction." Wow. Now, I know Bush and Powell and Cheney, they're all out there still trying to make the case for war, but you know what? When the Polish figure out the gag, isn't...
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Sam Cedar with Janine Garofalo, and you just heard a little sample of Bill Maher from his show, HBO's Real Time. Bill, I have a question for you. When you changed, when you shown the door at ABC to go to HBO, did it affect your sense of how the corporate media is sort of problematic, and I don't know. I mean, did it?
I was already in my 40s, so it wasn't like that was a big surprise that ABC, owned by the Disney Corporation, would get rid of a show that had started some controversy, especially right after 9/11. What was a surprise that the Disney Corporation would have ever bought a show called Politically Incorrect. But obviously they just thought it was a cute title back in the mid-90s, and I don't think they ever really knew what I did for a living when they hired me. I certainly wasn't surprised the way it went down. It's no secret, I've told people before, I cleaned out my office like the first week after it happened. I said, well, I don't want to be the last one to have the door hit me in the ass, so I knew it was going down.
Well, it's interesting that you were, you were given a lot of grief over what had been said on Politically Incorrect, when if you go back to the Clinton era, some of the things that were said about Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary on legitimate news programs seems to be much more controversial.
Talk about much more controversial. I was on, and this is the last time I ever did Howard Stern's show, when I made the tour after the controversy to explain myself, because I never got to really on my show, because it wasn't a controversy until, a few days later when they made it a controversy. But on the same show where Howard Stern is spending an hour berating me and raking me over the coals and trying to get me out of show business and make me say what I said was wrong, which I never did. While I'm doing that, he says, I think what we should do is drop an atomic bomb on a Muslim country. I don't care what Muslim country. It doesn't matter. Just drop a bomb on some Muslim country. That is not controversial. There's a statement which no one objects to.
Right. Well, and just
I just found that so ironic that I was defending myself for what I said, which, in retrospect does not even look controversial at all. I've heard at the recent Clark hearings, I've heard people basically make the same comment about how we were just firing cruise missiles and not really paying attention to terrorism.
Right. And going back to the climate of the Clinton era, when which is coming out more and more now in the trials, that when he wanted to push harder in Afghanistan and push harder on Al-Qaeda, that the rhetoric, as you remember, was that this was just a diversion from the Lewinsky scandal.
Right.
And all manner of very vulgar things were said about Bill Clinton at the time. And the very same people who were doing that now are, of course, the ones who will be the first to call foul if anyone says anything they perceive as a moderate about this president.
Look, this terrorism thing, I know the Bush White House finally has a problem with terrorism, which is a turn of the tide, because for so long this is what they were running on. But they, no matter how they spin it, they cannot make go away the fact, and it is a fact, that before 9/11, terrorism was way, way down on their list. And the proof of that is Richard Clark himself. Richard Clark was the terrorism guy. He was, for 10 years, through 3 administrations, he was the guy. And the fact that he was demoted, that office was demoted in the Bush White House, Dick Cheney had it right when Dick Cheney said he wasn't in the loop. He was the terrorism guy. If the terrorism guy wasn't in the loop, that says it all about how important it was to them. Which is not to say that we're blaming them for 9/11. 9/11 probably would have happened anyway, and all of us are responsible. Not just the Democrats, not just the Republicans. The media is responsible. I am responsible. I've said it before, I'll say it again. I had a forum for all those years in the 90s where I talked about, I was never shy about my opinions. I could have been saying over and over again, we should be paying more attention to terrorism. Just like I was screaming about the drug war and 12 other things that bothered me. And I never did either. So we're all responsible. We all could have done more. But no matter how they try to spin it at the Bush White House, they cannot deny it, that they had a list of things that were important to them before 9/11, and terrorism was way further down that list than it was for the Clinton White House. Because the Clinton White House, on their watch, they had stuff happen. The first World Trade Center bombing, the embassy bombings, the coal event. So they were much more into terrorism. They knew it was going to happen again. They were frantic about it. They had meetings about it every week. The Bush people, you know their attitude about the Middle East. It was, come on, you fight among yourselves, I'll be on the ranch, whatever. You know, they made a big change, and they can't spin it away.
Well, you know, why is it so, taken for granted, though, that they couldn't have done anything about 9/11? I mean, because the fact of the matter is that when the Clinton administration was that in touch and that sort of attuned to the terrorist threat, they broke up attacks in New York City that were planned for the United Nations.
And out here in L.A., the airport.
And the Millennium bombing at the L.A. airport, and against U.S. commercial aircraft in the Pacific. And they developed a rapid response plan to deal with chemical and biological. And then really, I mean, this is the thing that really starts to annoy me as we go. And one of the things that I thought was amazing about the commission was to hear Sandy Berger speak, because I had always assumed that maybe the Clintons really didn't take it that seriously, but it sounds like they did.
They did take it seriously. Clinton has told me that himself a couple of years ago, before this was even an issue. But beyond that, I mean, George Tenet testified that he was, you know, I think it was Richard Armitra, I said that George Tenet was going around town literally pounding on desks saying that something is going to happen in the summer of 2001. It wasn't like they weren't warned. I'm not saying that it wouldn't have happened if Clinton was there, but yes, there is definitely that possibility, and the idea that the media wouldn't even entertain that thought shows that there is not a liberal media. And that's why I'm glad you guys are there.
It's not even an objective media.
Right.
I mean, I'm not looking for a liberal media.
Right.
I'm just looking for one that does their job.
Exactly. You know what? It's so funny because Ann Coulter and I always have this little argument. We both think the media is lousy. She always says it's because they're liberal. And I always say, you know what? Look at this story you're complaining about. I'm telling you, it's not because they're liberal. It's because they're lazy, stupid, and bitchy.
And whorish.
Yeah.
You know, that's your friendship with Ann Coulter, which a lot of people make a lot of. It does strike me as weird, though, because one of your main tenets of your stand-up one I saw, which was just great, Victory Begins at Home, you were saying we cannot tolerate intolerance.
Right.
And Ann Coulter is very, very, very intolerant, at least her public persona is. I don't know what she's like behind closed doors, but her public persona is so intolerant as to be absurd, and yet you tolerate it very well on your show.
But that is what tolerance means. That's so funny.
But you said you can't tolerate intolerance.
Well, what I'm saying is you can't tolerate the kind of intolerance I was talking about that some people excuse in the Muslim world because it runs up against political correctness. I mean, I do jokes sometimes about not just Muslims, terrorists themselves, and people will... Well, I hear a groan. I had a joke in my act about terrorists are good at laundering money. It's the one thing they do launder. And there was this groan. Almost half the time I do it, with like, come on, Bill, don't make fun of terrorists. Don't make fun of the people who attacked us, man, which I find astounding. But, you know, tolerance means I'm not like you. I don't want to do what you do, but you can be that way.
Oh, I understand what you're saying. I totally understand you, but what I'm saying, she says things that are bordering on performance art. In fact, I do have a theory that she is Andy Kaufman, the female Tony Clifton.
That's so funny. I call her Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS. But, no, I mean, this is something you guys should absolutely run with, this idea. And it's not just Richard Clark, who, by the way, you know, everything I talk about the media not getting it, everything I read in the media about Richard Clark puts it as an either-or situation. Either Richard Clark is a scorned person who is looking for payback, and therefore he's not credible, or he is credible and he's telling the truth. But I think that the truth lies with both of these. He is scorned. I believe he is looking for payback. But I also believe he's telling the truth, and there's no reason why they're mutually exclusive.
Right. Yeah, people say he's politicizing it. Well, it is political.
Well, I think what it is that if he didn't feel scorned, then he just wouldn't have said anything. But just the fact that he's opening his mouth and telling his tale doesn't mean that that tale is a lie. It just means that if he wasn't bitter about the Bush administration, he wouldn't tell it at all. But he doesn't have to lie to get his revenge on the Bush administration. All he has to do is tell the truth.
I mean, based upon everything he's been saying up until this point, it's really he just has to stop lying. I mean, because they had him... Clark. I mean, they had him going out and shilling for the president in background, supposedly, and it just came out. But now it's basically he just has to tell the story as it was, rather than sort of...
Right. I mean, I don't doubt that he has a political motivation. I don't doubt that he is embittered. I just think it's logically false to say that, therefore, ipso facto, he's lying. No. Ipso facto, he's just getting his revenge. He just happens to have, I think, truthful ammunition that will get him that revenge. And if they had treated him nicely, then he wouldn't be telling his tale.
Bill, we're going to take a short break right now, and then we're going to come back and talk to you some more.
Okay.
Here on The Majority Report.
The Majority Report continues. Evenings 8 to 11 on AM 620 KDOJ, Portland's progressive talk station.
Welcome back to The Majority Report. With Janine Garofalo and Sam Cedar. We're on the line with HBO's Bill Maher.
Bill, I wanted to ask you something about the FCC and the Janet Jackson boob flap, as it's called, the boob, or boob gate, which Sam prefers.
The nipple that broke the camel's back.
Yes, and when it happened during Super Bowl Sunday, the same day that CBS would not air the MoveOn.org Child's Pay commercial because they felt it was too partisan, I don't know why. But that I did not see the Janet Jackson segment, and I didn't see the Super Bowl, but there was a bunch of messages on my machine from news sources asking me to comment on the boob flap, and I just assumed they were talking about Toby Keith. I didn't know that what had really happened.
Yeah.
But one thing that I wanted to talk to you about is, now, there's a guest, a really good guest you have on your show a lot. I think her name is Heather Wilson, is that correct? Is it the woman...
Congressman Heather Wilson, yeah.
And she's the one who was so upset at the hearings.
Yes, she was. I talked to her about it.
Yes, and you had made note of that on your show, and I also had noted it looked like she was going to cry. And
yeah.
Which is fine. That's fine. You know, she was very outraged because her son had witnessed Janet Jackson's boob. But what struck me about that is she is a real apologist for the president and his invasion and occupation policies, which I find much more indecent. You know, when she's on your show, she's very, very much a hardliner, that she just basically agrees with everything the president says in regards to the invasion and occupation with Iraq, and also will never concede an inch about how the mainstream media sort of helped sell that war. And I find that very indecent as far as her son is concerned as well. And I sort of don't understand why the culture war is always something that gets people so hepped up. Whereas when it comes to issues of violence and carnage and war, they are much less so. Do you find that to be the case?
Yes, of course. Well, you know, Bush has a war chest of $150 million. With $150 million, you could convince people to drink paint. You could convince a drink of vanilla paint if he had another $50 million. But that's not new, and being aroused at nothing is not new. Take it from someone who was in the glare once from being aroused about nothing. That's what this country does best. It panics about nothing. I mean, I still can't believe the Janet Jackson thing. I mean, it's one of those things where I say to myself and to other people sometimes, I'm literally embarrassed to be an American. Am I ashamed to be an American? No. I still think this is the best country for various reasons we won't go into now. But there are times when we are so childish that I just want to tell people I'm from Switzerland. I don't know who those people are who freaked out, but they're not. That's not my people. I mean, you would think by the reaction that he had ejaculated on her. If I had not seen it and didn't know what was going on, I would think it was a money shot. I would have thought that Justin Timberlake had taken his penis out of his pants and done something a lot more amazing than just one flashy second of a nipple.
I think with new FCC regulations, we're not allowed to say pants.
Congratulations, Bill. You just got a suit for the first time. We actually were hoping to get sued before Franken's show, and this, I think, we may be doing it.
Well, you know, who knows? You know, we were just told you're not allowed to say pants anymore.
It would be the best thing that could happen to you.
That's exactly it.
You know, the boob flap is another thing where people mistake that for liberal media. They mistake TNA, and they mistake Aaron Spelling's sexuality for liberal bias in the media sometimes. I think people, because I heard people complaining, That's what happens with, you know, the liberal media, that you see a woman's breast. That's ratings. That's corporate media. That's for-profit media.
Right.
That's not liberal. That has nothing to do with liberalism.
Well, one thing I raised with Heather Wilson when I had her on talking about this was, I said, you know, the FCC is the body, the corporate body, as you call it, the governmental body, whatever, that's so incensed about this. But if you want to talk about outrage and the FCC, how about the fact that over the last 8 years, the FCC's regulators have accepted over 2,500 free trysts from the people they are supposed to be regulating? And I went on to explain that, you know, Congresswoman, when people get trysts, they tend to think well of the people who gave them trysts. People like trysts. People like to go away. They do. They get wined, dined, and concubined. It's an excellent way to make a friend. Give them a trip. So for the FCC regulators to have accepted these trips, and they were all, by the way, to places like New York, New Orleans, Las Vegas, you know, fun vacation places. And then to be outraged at a nipple for 1 second, but of course it happened during, you know, and I love what the answer to that is. Well, you know, it's not that it was a nipple, it was that it was during the Super Bowl. Oh, right. It was at church. That's what happened. It happened during church.
They had those terrible beer commercials during the Super Bowl. They had all manner of what could be considered vulgar commercials during the Super Bowl.
Yes. It's selling ill health, you know. I mean, they say they're not they wouldn't accept advocacy ads, but of course, what they really advocate is eating badly and drinking.
And low self-esteem, so that you have to buy deodorant so you smell better.
Well, I don't know if I think that's a stretch, but...
Well, it's possible. It's a possible stretch. I use it to justify my not wearing...
But a lot of people, when they do tired rants about Madison Avenue, don't they, like, always say, and the deodorant salesman on Madison Avenue? That's just an old trite rant for some reason that gets trotted out.
That's right along with that. They sell presidents like they do dog food, man.
And the fat cats... Cook in the books. How many times, if I had a nickel for every time I heard cook in the books at one time last year, I'd have a whole stack of nickels.
Right.
A lot of nickels.
Yeah.
So, well, let me ask you this. Just, I wanted to ask you your advice as to what we should do with our show. Janine didn't want me to ask you. But, I mean, what would you say is your sort of, I mean, your show is obviously not just a typical comedy show. It might have some sort of thematic.
It's a good comedy show.
Yeah, it's a good. It actually is.
That's what I'm going for. Yeah.
One of the few shows that I think is worth watching on television these days. But
thanks.
Although HBO is not television.
And a lot of people felt really invigorated by it to hear the voice, the perspective that was coming from your show when it first came on the air. I can remember just cheering in my living room, as I'm sure millions of other Americans were. And the only reason I didn't want him to ask your advice was not because I don't respect your show, but because I thought you'd find it. Silly.
Is that a silly question?
First of all, I'm not even though my father was a radio guy, I wish he was around to tell you because he knew a lot more about radio than I did. I've never really done radio. I think it's great that this is on because I think there is a complete imbalance in radio. It's only the right wing that gets heard. And I'm sure, you know, you have heard ad nauseum all the warnings about how the left wing can't do radio because they just want the red meat. I would ignore that. I think ideas that the media puts out about what the people will accept are never true. I remember when Seinfeld first went on, they said, it's too Jewish, too New York. Yeah, right, whatever. I remember when Letterman moved to 11:30, they said, oh, that could never work at 11:30. People were okay with it. You know, don't believe any of that stuff. I think, as the NPR show is called, All Things Considered, that's what the great thing about liberals is. Unlike conservatives, they're willing to consider all things.
And on that note, Bill, we thank you so very much.
Yes,
that
is
excellent that you're our first guest. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, see you soon. Okay.
That was Bill Maher from HBO's Real Time, and you are listening to The Majority Report on Air America Radio. Back to the Majority Report. My name is Sam Cedar. I am sitting alongside one of America's greatest patriots, Janine Garofalo. A little later in the show, we will have another great patriot and an extremely funny one as well, Dave Chappelle from The Chappelle Show. But before we get to Chappelle, next up, we have what I like to call an Uber blogger. And for those of you who don't know what a blog is, it's basically a website. But one of the things that Janine and I are hoping to do is to increase your ability to get more information about what's really going on out there. And the, one of the best resources out there are blogs. They're little websites that that people write up and people communities form around and keep people informed. And as part of an ongoing series, we have one of our regular guest bloggers, Atrios from Eschaton, on the line. Atrios, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hey, Sam, how you doing?
Good, how you doing?
Good.
And Janine is here.
Hello.
Hi, Janine. So, congratulations on the new show.
Thank you. Thank you for being our first among our first guests.
Among your first guests. Well, Bill Maher had to go first, I understand. Yeah, I've been listening. It's been a lot of fun, although I think you did make Bill run away a little bit with your Ann Coulter question. He didn't really want to go there.
Right. Well, when you know people, it changes everything. That's one of the problems with it being inside the Beltway, and
sure.
It's almost like a blue shield of silence that the movie Serpico deals with that.
America. Everybody knows everybody, and nobody says a bad word.
Yeah, he freaked out when you said the thing about Andy Kaufman, which I think we
he didn't freak out.
I got the sense that maybe he knows something.
That he might know that she is indeed Andy Kaufman, the next phase after Tony Clifton.
Yeah, I mean, it's the perfect...
it's the perfect explanation.
It's the perfect comedy.
I think we need an investigation about this, an in-depth investigation.
Well, if you'll help us, we're up for it.
Okay, we need to figure out, is Andy Kaufman Ann Coulter?
Mm-hmm.
Either that, or she could be some type of changeling.
Shape-shifter.
Could be one of the lizards. Yeah, shape-shifting lizard.
Yeah, she could be one of the lizard people from the lizard invasion. A lot of people who really believe that you know, the lizards are here with us, and Ann Coulter could be one of them.
They come out of Mount Shasta.
Yeah.
The inner terrestrials that come out of Mount Shasta, and they all dress up, and they all look like Ann Coulter. Maybe they're not even shape-shifting. Maybe that's actually just their only shape. Atrios, what we are hoping that you'll be able to provide for us on a weekly basis is a little insight to some of the stories that are going on in the media, but more information and better information than we get from the so-called corporate media.
Sure, hopefully I can do that. You know, a couple things happened in today a little bit and over the past week, which, you know, really, I have to say maybe a little annoyed. And I get annoyed a lot, so that's, you know, but this made me a little bit more annoyed than usual. And that was, well, two things. One was the what you mentioned earlier in the show, and that was the David Letterman situation. And you described that earlier where basically David Letterman had a clip of a kid standing behind the president and during a speech and basically not behaving appropriately. And then the White House informed CNN that the clip wasn't real, and then they came up with another story, and then CNN changed the story. You know, you went all through this before. And the amazing thing is you know, the you know, what is going on here? I mean, is the White House so plugged into CNN that they just call them up and make any claim whatsoever and CNN just runs with it without question?
Well, we know they're plugged into Fox. That is absolutely
well,
fact. That Fox is a handmaiden of the White House. That they are on the phone. Roger Ailes is on the phone all the time with the White House. And when there is an attack afoot against any dissenter, Dick Clark being the latest, and boy, they've got a laundry list of people's characters to besmirch.
Right, and the other thing with Dick Clark, and this is the other thing I wanted to bring up, but this is about Wolf Blitzer, another CNN character. Love the name Wolf. Anyway, and about a week ago, Wolf Blitzer said on his show something along the lines that I'll half quote it here, what administration officials have been saying since the weekend about Richard Clark was that he wants to make a few bucks, and in his own personal life, while they're also suggesting that there are some weird aspects in his life as well. They don't know what made this guy come forward. So basically, you know, pushing this line that somebody told him, he says administration officials told him that there's something weird with his personal life. He wasn't going to tell us what. Okay. Now, the rumor's been going around that they're trying to, you know, smear him by claiming that he's gay. I don't know why that's weird or, you know, lots of gay people. It's not particularly weird, but nonetheless, that was the line that they were pushing. And Paul Krugman, you know, put the quote in his column. And after Paul Krugman put the quote in his column, Blitzer came back and said that, you know, he didn't really say what Paul Krugman said. In context, he meant something completely different. But if you read what he said, he meant exactly what Paul Krugman said. And so, you know, it really sounds like he's trying to cover for whatever senior administration officials or administration officials were trying to push this personal smear onto him, which he, you know, conveniently passed on to his viewers and then realized maybe he made a boo-boo.
Adrius, can I ask you about the question that didn't have enough legs at all, as far as I'm concerned, is about the character assassination that was attempted on Joe Wilson, former Ambassador Joe Wilson, and his wife, the undercover CIA operative that was outed by the White House with the help of Bob Novak.
Sure.
Can you tell the audience more about that? I know you have other things to get to, too, but I think that's an important one that really should have had much more impact
right.
on the mainstream media.
Well, this was, you know, way, way, way back, you know, last summer. You had Joe Wilson, who had basically come out and said that, you know, he was the one who basically said, look, you know, the stuff about Niger and the yellow cake and, you know, buying uranium from Africa, you know, this just wasn't true. And the White House should have known it's true. I went to Niger, and, you know, it just wasn't true. And then pretty soon afterwards, according to two senior administration officials, okay, some other senior administration officials had been called up a bunch of journalists, and as a way of exacting revenge, somehow they told the journalists that Wilson's wife was a member of the CIA. And apparently she was a member of the CIA. She was a covert operative for the CIA. And revealing her identity, potentially, who knows what kind of damage it caused. It could have endangered the lives of other operatives or contacts all around the world, as well as just generally endangering our intelligence gathering capabilities.
And it's a federal offense, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
It's even if you do it, even if you do it somewhat unknowingly,
right?
It is a federal offense.
It is. You know, the journalist is okay. Journalists are basically off the hook, so Robert Novak is mostly off the hook, as long as he doesn't display a pattern of doing it. You know, if he was outing CIA agents every week, okay, they could go after him. But if he just does it once, he's probably okay. But, you know, people in the know, people, you know, who are basically guardians of this knowledge, yeah, it's a felony.
Now, journalists, when they say senior administration officials, that's a euphemism for journalists, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, senior administration officials, it basically means, you know, the president, vice president, the cabinet, some important deputies. You know, it's maybe up to 60 people that could meet, but no more than that. It's probably really generally less than that. Usually senior administration officials means, you know, cabinet member or important deputy cabinet members, but that's it.
But didn't Bob Novak also help to report on the memos that were clandestinely downloaded from Democrats' computers, which the Republicans were knowingly taking memos that were not for their eyes, and they would be leaking them to people like Bob Novak?
Right. This is a staffer working with Senator Hatch in the Judiciary Committee, and he, you know, professes to this day, he's been very honest about what he did. He just claims he did no wrong, that, you know, it's not a crime to peek into other people's computers as long as you can figure out how to do it and steal the memos. And so they were basically stealing all the Democrats' strategy memos that they were passing around to each other about how to deal with judicial appointments, and they were passing it out to friendly journalists on the right, which of course include Robert Novak, and they were gleefully reporting them. You know, Novak, you know, he has an odd history. I mean, Novak also had problems a few years ago when he admitted in a column that one of his informants was Robert Hansen, the convicted spy who was spying for Russia, and he was an FBI member. And, you know, again, here's a situation where, you know, you had somebody who was a, you know, he was a player for the right. He was a conservative, Opus Dei Catholic. He was very close to the FBI director, Louis Free. And, you know, it's probably the case, it's hard not to imagine, that he wasn't responsible for sort of leaking a lot of information to the press about Clinton over that time, because that would have made sense. But only Robert Novak has come forward at all and said that he was one of, that Hansen was one of his sources, but, you know, one can imagine that there are plenty of other journalists who use him for a source and haven't bothered to tell us yet.
You know, if it were the shoe was on the other foot and Paul Begala had done what Bob Novak has done, wouldn't you think that the right-wing radio world would have demanded his head on a stick?
Well, if it were just the right-wing radio world, I wouldn't be too upset about it. I mean, we're used to that. That's life. But the problem is, you know, the right-wing radio world now has spilt over entirely into the mainstream media. You know, what starts off on Newsmax or on Rush Limbaugh's show ends up on NBC a couple nights later. It just happened. On NBC, Lisa Myers reported something which didn't even make any sense, which came right off of Newsmax's webpage. And this has been going on for a long time, where, you know, the RNC has, you know, worked very closely with some news organizations, especially NBC, especially during the Clinton years and during the 2000 election campaign. The BBC the BBC did a documentary called Digging the Dirt about, and they had video where they showed, you know, reporters with the AP basically, you know, taking the opposition research the RNC would give them and writing it down verbatim. They had video of Tim Russert actually calling the RNC opposition research people and asking them if they had any more And, you know, the reporters were telling them that, oh, you know, just give us more stuff. You know, we trust you, you know. So they're lazy, and they're not even fact-checking this stuff.
Well, it's unbelievable. I mean, I hate to be redundant, and I have a feeling this is going to end up being my my catchphrase. But really, most reporters, if not, let's say 51% to 49%, we can build from there, are horse. And with that said, we're going to take a break on the Majority Report. You're listening to Gene Garofalo and Sam Cedar on Air America Radio, and we are talking to Atrios. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Still to come, Comedy Central's Dave Chappelle will be coming up the second half of this hour. And on the line, we have Atrios from the ever-popular blog Eschaton. Atrios, I it's funny because today, right as Janine was calling me about Letterman, I saw that entry you put up today about Letterman.
Right.
And in addition to that, I've been saying for weeks to our research people, there was a G8 summit. Okay,
right.
This goes to Condoleezza Rice's testimony when she says, or statements when she says, I don't think anybody could have predicted that these people would take an airplane and slam it into a building, et cetera, which she since sort of backed off on.
Right.
And has sort of parsed her words. What is she saying now?
Well, she backed off on it and basically said, while it hadn't occurred to her, obviously it perhaps could have occurred to other people in the intelligence community. And then, very, very strangely, one of the spokesmen came out, and this is just truly bizarre. One of the spokesmen came out and said, you know, that Rice had not received any briefings about airplanes flying into buildings, and you know, as of the spring of 2002. Meaning, even after they flew airplanes into buildings, she didn't hear any briefings about airplanes flying into buildings. So it's a very strange thing to say. But more to the point, I mean, we know that in the summer of 2001, before September 11th, that George Bush went to Italy for the G8 summit. And, you know, they had massive amounts of security, including, anti-aircraft capabilities. And the explicit stated concerns, and this was due to an intelligence report that they had gotten from Egypt, apparently, they had terrorist warnings that the terrorists were going to basically get planes, load them up with explosives, and fly them into the summits and, you know, basically kill all the world leaders. And so it's very bizarre that, you know, Rice is going to claim that, you know, she wasn't even aware of, as National Security Advisor, she wasn't even aware of the reasons behind the security preparations for the president when he was flying out of the country. So it's truly, truly strange.
Well, this is where I am about to do probably my first and last piece of reporting that ever to take place in the Majority Report, other than, what somebody else has dug up.
Mm-hmm.
But, we were looking for those articles, which you somehow just whipped out of your back pocket and linked to The Guardian Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
The one you're referencing was from July 11th, 2001. And the headline is Missiles to Protect Summit Leaders, specifically from planes flying into the summit.
Right.
And not only was Bush there, which maybe it's possible that, I mean, it's really impossible to imagine that we were not told, that the American government was not told why there were why there were missiles there. But also Gary Edson was there, who was, according to the White House site, was appointed the newly created position of Deputy Assistant to the President for Economic Affairs and Deputy National Security Advisor.
Okay, so he should have known about it.
Theoretically, I mean,
right.
Even when they drove into the summit, you'd think somebody would have said, what are those large anti-aircraft missiles doing?
What do they do? What are they for? They look neat. Yeah, you think. And you think maybe he might want to, he might have wanted to tell his boss, Condoleezza Rice, Dr. Rice, as she likes to be called, about, wow, planes flying into buildings. Wow, there's something we should think about.
Why doesn't anybody in the media report that?
I don't know. There are a lot of things, like that. And one of the things about Richard Clark is that most of what he's talking about, obviously, a lot of the details are new because they're personal. They're personal recollections. But, a big chunk of what he's talking about now was actually in Time magazine in the summer of 2002. But it was a big, major investigative piece, and they put it out there, and it just sunk like a stone, right? Nobody ever talked about it. Nobody ever picked up on it. Nobody ever thought it was important. And partially just because, you know, we were in the run-up to the Iraq War, and that was really important, and, you know, we weren't going to say anything bad.
Well, you know, that rule of not saying anything bad only seems to extend to the Republican Party.
Right.
You know, when Clinton was in office and Kosovo was going on and Operation Desert Fox and any other conflicts, it was still fair game to criticize the president and his wife and daughter, depending on how distasteful some right-winger wanted to get. During the conflicts.
You're talking about the junkie Rush Limbaugh that Dick Cheney had a conversation with the other day, right?
Right, which shows the desperation. When Dick Cheney goes on Rush Limbaugh, you know that they're circling the wagon.
They're losing the ditto heads. They're worried they're not going to go vote. And a lot of them are getting pretty unhappy. Some of them have even lost their jobs.
But yeah, that's actually true. Although, you know, the Republican Party likes to pretend that they represent the working man.
Sure.
Which the union-busting Republican Party, the outsourcing frenzied Republican Party. It is always shocking to me when they pretend on the right and in the world of right-wing radio that somehow they're speaking for the common working-class guy and gal when they are nothing more than corporate profiteers.
Right. You know, there's a lot of myths about the Republican Party. I want to touch on actually something Bill Maher said when he was talking about how Republicans really embrace nostalgia, that, you know, one of their, you know, sort of their key sort of themes is this nostalgia for a past. And Bill said it was a past that existed but didn't exist for most people. But I think he's wrong about that. I don't think this past that they pine away for, sometimes it's, you know, the 50s and sometimes it's the 1890s, I'm not sure really where they want to go back to. But, you know, the past is a myth. I mean, it's this myth they've constructed about a better time, which never existed. Not only did it not exist for, you know, African Americans and Jews and, you know, most, you know, big part of the country, it also didn't exist for most white people. It really didn't exist at all. I mean, the 50s, you know, that we think about, it's a myth. It didn't exist.
Right. It's the good old days that never were. And,
exactly.
You know, people, as if Happy Days is a historical chronicling of the 50s.
Right.
And when Trent Lott said, this is before the Trent Lott flap, I can remember him saying the 50s were a good time for America.
Right.
Well, really? But go ask the majority of Americans who went through the 50s. They would probably say it's better now for people, for more people, more inclusive. And I also find it very strange when it's put into speeches. You know, it's a political stump speeches that mythologizing is more important than talking about facts
right.
in a political stump speech.
Mm-hmm. Well, they like myths. I mean, they're nice things to cling to. And you know, we're guilty of that too on our side. It's not as if we never, you know, make mythic characters out of, you know, some of our heroes in the left. But, you know, we're not always pining away for what never was.
But, you know, the liberals are to be thanked for all the good things we do have. You know, I don't understand how liberal became a dirty word, but thanks to liberal reform, we do have things that make today better, as in desegregation, child labor laws, birth control, seat belts, environmental protections, 40-hour work weeks. All of these things are liberal, and all of those things speak for working families.
No, those things are all bad, though. We need to get rid of all of them.
That's what a conservative would tell you, so that they con 50% of Americans into voting against their better interests all the time. Unfortunately, we have to wrap things up. Sandy, do you have one more thing you want to say?
Well, I just wanted to, Atrius, before we go, tell us how much has been raised through your site for John Kerry's reelection.
I've become a bundler. That is, people can, you know, donate through John Kerry to John Kerry through my website by clicking on the appropriate link, and it keeps track of that. So about $118,000. So
that's a big bundle.
Officially, that makes me a national campaign vice chairman. Although they haven't actually told me what that means yet, or even, you know, said thank you yet. So I don't know. But anyway. So.
Well, and on behalf of us, thank you.
Yes. And if you had raised that for the Bush campaign, you'd be a member of the Reichstag now, right? Or how's
you'd
that
be
work?
A pioneer and part of the 43rd Reich.
I would be a pioneer. Yes,
all right.
Yes, I would.
Well, Atrios, thank you very much. We look forward to hearing from you again next week. You've been listening to Atrios from Eschaton, the website Eschaton, which is available on the web at atrios.blogspot.com.
And we'll be right back with Dave Chappelle here on The Majority Report.
Now back to Janine and Sam. Evenings 8 to 11 on AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's progressive talk station.
Welcome back to The Majority Report. I'm Janine Garofalo here with Sam Cedar, and it is a great thrill and a pleasure and an honor to be sitting next to one of the funniest people in America and a cultural icon, I might add, Dave Chappelle. Welcome.
Chappelle.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Can you hear me at all?
I sure hope so. Can we... This is the technical problem I was talking about on our first day.
We are being sabotaged by a right-wing conspiracy.
Let's try this.
You know, we,
Hello?
Yeah.
There you go.
Hey, I'm on the air.
While you were talking into the one that doesn't work, is just one of the many things, if our audience will bear with us, is just the first day of the
we
show.
We expect
here.
To get these things ironed out within at least 2 or 3 months.
No, that's why I came. I like to get in on the ground floor. That's my whole... That's my whole thing.
Right. And what was when you first started Chappelle Show, which is that wildly successful, and I would say, the reason I also say cultural icon, I cannot go anywhere now without hearing the kids doing your Lil Jon.
Oh, yeah.
All the time. And you're waiting for the summer, whatever. What?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, that whole Lil Jon thing is now as much as Caddyshack was when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Doing the Caddyshack.
I can't go in there without hearing it, and it's driving me insane.
But you've really struck a chord with the culture, not only because it's very, very funny, but because you resonate not just with the Lil Jon bit, but the more things where you show that there are two Americas, two legal systems,
yeah.
two sets of rules that exist, and that one of the things that really, if I may be so bold to say, moved me when you were doing the sitcom, and because of FCC regulations, I don't know if we can say the name of the sitcom, you could say it.
And I
no, he can't say it.
It was called The Untitled Dave Chappelle Project.
No, I'm talking about the sitcom you did within your show, and you said, this racism is killing me.
That one. Right. The Nigger Family.
Yeah, yeah.
N-I-G-G-A-R. Don't worry, everybody. Right. Don't be alarmed, everybody.
But we have such rules impressed upon us. We had a legal meeting. We can't say anything. At all, so that's why I was being overcautious with you. But
well, I'm just here for the night. It was called the Nigger Family,
right? And when you said this racism is killing me, you really meant it. You were making it funny, but I think that people can sense, or I do in the audience, that you are coming from such a deeper place than just broad comedy, just going for laughs. Your sketches are so intelligent, so thought out, and then there is some sophomoric stuff thrown in there, but it's okay because you're smart.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I have both of those things exist in me. There's a smart Dave, and then there's the eternal 11-year-old. But I just like having fun doing stuff like this. And I feel that the thing I'm proud about my show is that it feels genuine. It feels like it happens on Earth. You know what I mean? Most of television is like the least objectionable program.
Right.
And that means that you can't do anything that's realistic, like life. Is way more offensive than TV, and television doesn't really reflect anything that life is about nowadays. And especially comedy, I feel like should be somewhat critical or something.
Right, well, and most good comics are social critics.
Yeah. Everyone who's remembered was a social critic.
Exactly. What's the point of it if there is no point of it?
Yeah, man. So I just feel like, the show, for that, it's been a lot of fun. And it's like, it is kind of like a form of expression. Like, it's so hard to make something in show business that is expressive like that.
You know, you had recently the sketch, which I was going back to the two Americas about two justice systems, where you had, what if the situations were reversed, where you had the drug dealer being treated like a corporate criminal.
Right,
and the corporate criminal being treated like a... poor person in this country.
Yeah. Everything that these guys do, for some reason, is so sanitized. Like when Rush Limbaugh was popping pills, he's not a drug addict. There's a big difference between a guy like that and a guy that, you know, even the laws will reflect that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, white people are like, well, we sniff powder. These black people are smoking, which makes them, they got to do four times the time we got to do. Whatever it is. Stuff like that is always like these inconsistencies. Everybody knows about them. No one really talks about them. So it's just there to be made fun of.
Well, fortunately, when we say Rush Limbaugh, we always like to use the respectable term of the junkie Rush Limbaugh, because he is he's a heroin junkie or a hillbilly.
He's
heroin.
In recovery.
No, yes, but once a junkie, always a junkie. And I'm just asking the question.
I don't know, but if Rush Limbaugh were black, or if Rush Limbaugh were poor, the outcome of the OxyContin scandal would have been much different for him.
Well, I think that double standard always existed. That's why I could do race jokes indefinitely. It's like an inexhaustible source of material, man. Like, you know, here we are living in a free country that was founded on slavery. So, hey, man, paradox and irony and all those good things, that's what comedy's made of. And that's why I could just do it. Like, really, I could never stop doing it.
Do you find that there is what I call sort of a acceptable racism commentators get away with on cable news a lot, where they go on these faux outrage campaigns against a hip-hop person or a rapper who is representing a soda, and then they will try to encourage a letter-writing campaign against the company for sponsoring this particular rapper because they use bad language or they have some type of sex scandal, where it seems to be that a lot of right-wingers go after on these nonsense family values type of platforms. We have to get Coca-Cola to stop using Usher, like that. It's just, to me, racist. That it's bad for families, it's bad for kids. What's bad for families and kids is this administration, is globalization, is corporate crime. That's bad for families. So why do you think that there are so many right-wingers who pretend that what's bad for families is Whitney Houston and Bobby Brown?
You know, that's one of those, like, mysteries, like the Sphinx. I don't know. I'll tell you what it looks like from my living room. It does look racist, and it looks real petty. It looks real like they're really out of touch with anything that's happening. You know, I really can't get into the mind of a person like that. Like, there's so many things on. I don't feel like I'm a prisoner to consumerism like that. Like, my television doesn't hold me hostage and make me watch it. I turn the channels if something comes on that I don't like, I don't agree with. And all this outcry, this seems like, in contrast to what's actually happening in the world, it seems like, what's the big deal? For instance, you know, wars are happening. Yeah. Things like this. I just think there's a lot of things that are more detrimental than ludicrous selling Pepsi.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that boob flap, as it was, becomes so relevant at a time when we've got soldiers dying on a daily basis.
By boob flap, he means Janet Jackson. It's called the boob flap or boob gate.
Yeah, and if I was a soldier in Iraq, I'd have been happy to see Janet Jackson. I'd have been like, man, I'm glad that the Super Bowl comes on over here.
Bring up the TiVo and let's rewind it seven times.
I think a bigger problem is how lame the halftime shows are. I would say the people that they choose in the lip syncing is just bad TV.
I didn't even watch the Super Bowl. And then I heard about Janet. I was so upset that I didn't watch it. Thank God for the internet, because I was one of those people that logged on afterwards. But, you know, just the fact that it was such a big deal and people, I don't know, man.
She couldn't go to the Grammys unless she apologized. And then, of course, Justin Timberlake wimped out. He didn't know anything about it.
That was a huge mistake on his part. He, like, lost all his street credibility.
Oh, he had some?
He had built up some street credibility.
What, after he was a Musketeer?
Well, long after the Musketeer thing. But then it's like, you apologize because, you know, not even that he just apologized, but he said, I was appalled by, like, can't say I was appalled.
That was embarrassing.
Nobody was appalled by that.
That's the first time I think he ever used that word, too, I'm sure.
Yeah,
I was appalled.
I was appalled.
But was he using his street accent when he said that, or was he using his regular voice?
I say I was appalled by that.
Like, he flip-flops between what I call a black accent and his regular voice.
You know, I do that, too, I might have.
Oh, yeah. Let's hear an example.
I'm bilingual. I speak job interview. I mean, it just depends on who I'm talking to, man. Like, if I'm in a certain situation, I can't, you know, I take the rhythm out of my voice just to make them feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
And then so they don't draw certain conclusions about me that aren't true.
So what do you think the conclusions Justin Timberlake would like us to draw about him when he's using an accent that isn't actually particularly authentic?
That's a good question. I don't know that he's down in it.
He's been there.
He's funky like that. But he is funky like that. I did Star Search with Justin. I remember he was 12. At that time, he was doing a cowboy number. But that being said, the talent shone through.
Yeah?
Yeah. And since then, who's no telling what he's done? He might have gangbanged for fees. I don't know what he's been into.
There's a lot of cowboys who go right into gangbanging, I think.
Well, the thing I'm talking about is the you can't talk about that with the FCC.
Well, no. That's not... No, I wasn't implying that.
Well, then why were we getting that signal, the hand signal from the booth was saying that we can't?
Oh, my fault.
No. You're...
That's not a sexual act. Mm-hmm. That's the act when you go, you're a gang member and you...
And you
shoot
you
people.
You bang... Forget it. Let's move on. Right. But yeah, we're all hyper because of a legal meeting that was told what we can and can't do. Let's move on from there. It doesn't matter.
Do you get a lot of that?
Yeah, man. Oh, sure. You know... That's the thing. I can't tell. I usually just don't pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's just a lot easier. Because worst case scenario, they're going to sue the network.
Right.
I don't get any money from the network, so that's on them. You know.
Exactly. They have no leverage because they can't dock your pay because you're not getting that much.
Yeah, and plus, man, it's like, you know, I don't know, man. As long as you're not cursing or being, you know, don't worry about it.
So what is it, since you've been on the air and you are a person that people do consider provocative, because TV is so vanilla and so middle of the road, really anything is outside of that frame is considered provocative. What has been some of the fallout negatively to you? Do people in the street come up to you, give you a hard time, or do you get letters giving you a hard time?
I get very rarely I'll get like a dirty letter will make its way to my hands. Or I'll read something in the press that's like kind of, either, there's been one thing that was like, well, that's kind of flagrantly unfair. And then there's the other things that are just kind of subtly divisive, like, word, is that what you saw when he was sitting there talking to me? Is that, you know, these people, you know, they really should do stories about the people who write stories, just so, you know, because if somebody tells you something, you're always going to want to know about the source of the information.
Yeah.
Some of these people ain't the sharpest, you know, fairest people. It'd be nice to know that.
That's, I think, being very generous.
Yeah. Well, you know. So it's like, but for the most part, I really look at this as between me and the public. You know, the media is going to say what they're going to say. There's always going to be people that disagree with what you do or say if it's broadcasted out there. But, you know, man, yeah, live your life and, you know, I'll do it and whatever. I don't care.
But it's very frustrating to be deliberately misunderstood. I really believe that there are people who deliberately misunderstand what some comics do, and they have a faux outrage that they put out there, and I don't know what purpose it serves.
Well, you know what I find is that with people's criticism about the show normally has to do with criticizing something much larger than my show. Like, it might not be the show as much as, like, they have an issue with race, and so they'll make my show their platform for what they got to say about race or what they got to say about if there's two legal systems. Well, you know, people, you know, they just use it. But it has nothing to do with me. So.
Right, which is what happened to Jason Blair. I think that Jason Blair was so crucified, and I guess Jack Edwards, white guy from USA Today caught making up stories. So few people commented on that, but Jason Blair was commented on ad nauseum because I think people were commenting on larger issues of race, but in the negative, when they were attacking Jason Blair.
I don't even know about that. I mean, my whole thing with that was just, you know, there's a lot of things that a comedian, you know, finds funny about things. Things like the Jason Blair scandal. I really just felt like, you know, he's just a dude with a hard job and drug habit, fond of Cheetos, and he's just trying to make it, he's trying to make that deadline. I mean, he's calling from downstairs. I'm in Iowa, baby.
Right, well, that's what I'm saying. So many, it's being sort of lazy. And there's tons of journalists that suffer from that same issue. But Jason Blair had his feet held to the fire, I believe, because a lot of people were much more getting out their issues with race problems or their closet racism and taking it out on Jason Blair.
Yeah, he was like the fall guy for the media. Bush served up rice. That was my favorite headline. Bush served some rice.
Hang on, we'll talk about that when we come back after this short break with Dave Chappelle and the Majority Report.
I think it could be a black president one day, but you don't want to be the first one. I mean, second or third, that's fine, but that first nigga better watch out. I'm going to tell you that right now. I'm too hot. I mean, I'd be the first black president. I don't think that nobody would really, really hurt me. I'm sure somebody would want to hurt me. But I don't think they touch me because my vice president will be Mexican for a little insurance. You know what I'm saying? Well, you can shoot me if you want, but you're just going to open the border up, so.
Air America Radio, home of weapons of mass entertainment-related activities.
Now back to Janine and Sam, evenings 8 to 11 on AM 620 KDOJ, Portland's progressive talk station.
Mr. Chappelle, are you suggesting that because one of the detectives is a possible racist,
And because there may have been some minor oversights in the investigation that it completely lets O.J. off the hook.
Exactamundo, the defense wrestler.
Mr. Chappelle.
No further questions.
Will you at least admit that O.J. more than likely killed his wife?
Sir, my blackness will not permit me to make a statement like that.
You're dismissed.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Janine Garofalo, I'm Sam Cedar, and we are very fortunate to have the extremely funny Dave Chappelle
in
the studio.
Man, I'm happy to be here, Sam.
So we were talking about...
Bush serves up Condi Rice.
Funniest headline of all time, Bush serves up rice.
And it looks like she's going to be the fall guy or fall gal for this administration.
They're opening up doors for women everywhere. Finally, a woman.
Exactly.
And she's going to be the one to clean up the mess.
I think I just stepped on one of your jokes.
No, that's all good. I'm look, man, I haven't even been following the whole thing until, like, literally this morning. It's because I've been working like crazy. And I'm just going to say, like, I would be a paranoid to be a black person working in that kind of environment. Because I feel like I'm going to take the fall for something. I'd just be scared to death. But whatever she, you know.
Well, look what they do to Colin Powell. Unbelievable. They try him out at the UN to do that performance theater that Orson Welles, the Martians are landing in Grover's Mill, New Jersey. you know what I mean? He holds up the anthrax vial. Everything was nonsense. They had the doctored British reports that were plagiarized. They make him go out and do that because he's a team player and he's a good soldier. Almost everything he said was false, and then they turn around and blame him and the British.
And he was the only one who had any credibility in the administration. I mean, that's why they asked him to do it. And he doesn't have much of that left anymore, I don't think.
Kind of, but, hey, I don't know. He's a hard guy not to like, though. As a black dude, I can't help it, man. I just kind of feel bad for the guy. Like, man, he just looks tough.
Not so much his son, though.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Michael Powell's pretty easy to dislike, I would have to say.
Well, yeah, because he affects my day-to-day, my day-to-day work. Like, I can't say this, or Michael Powell might get it. But
slap a $20,000 fine on you.
Now up to $500,000.
$500,000 for saying something. What are we saying? It's so, what is that deep?
And yet you still can lie with impunity on the news, but you just can't say something off color in a comedy bit.
Man, it's just so weird, man. Especially with the line of work we have. You can, the idea, you know, just, they can't restrict everything.
Well, I think the idea is that, you know, start the cultural war a couple of months before the election so that, you know, liberals can be lumped in with...
Everything that's wrong. That's what they always do. There's always this BS culture war that's trotted out to distract voters, and so they're conned into voting against their better interests. You just make the story about Janet Jackson's boob, and then it knocks off the front page all the scandals going on within the Bush administration. That's classic Republican... tactic.
Yeah, you know, this is, I'll put it to you like this. I mean, maybe it's because it's the age I'm at. I can't remember being alive in such a politically charged time. Again, maybe I was alive then and didn't know. I was alive during Reagan.
Right.
Had a little bit of Carter in my life. I think I started out at the end of Nixon.
I remember it during Reagan. I remember the rise of the right and the rise of the BS culture war put in place of real news and put in place of real issues that we need to be conscious of for voting.
Well, I was young during Reagan, so all I remember is my parents being mad a lot. But, like, this, I don't know, man. This new, what's going on now just looks crazy, man. And, you know, I'm not even really a partisan dude. I'm, like, on the side of whatever's the most fair. And, which happens to lean towards the left of my thing right now.
Well, there's nothing wrong with being a partisan, though. There's nothing wrong with being a partisan if you're a partisan for the good.
Well, yeah, no, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I just don't look at myself as being, you know, I'm for what I'm for and I'm against what I'm against. My whole thing is just like, you know, if it's a democracy, just everybody live your life, everybody be free, and just don't let your freedoms infringe on the freedoms of other people, and everyone should be fine, you know. Like, things like gay marriage, it's like, yeah, I have no opinion about them like that. It's like, well, if they want to get married, why not? Is it the tax break? Is it...
healthcare. I mean, there's thousands of reasons to want to get married.
And also, even something as simple as if your partner is in the hospital, that you have visitation rights. to visit, you know, stay overnight in the room or what have you, to be with your partner and not be next of kin or a member of the family. That is also part of being married. But it's just, that's what I'm talking about. This is a wedge issue designed to distract us. Oh my gosh, that's the music that means we have to go away? Are we coming back with Dave or do we lose him now? We're coming back with Dave Chappelle here on The Majority
All
Report.
Right.
Welcome back to The Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar, sitting alongside Janine Garofalo, and we are honored to have our guest in the studio, Dave Chappelle from Dave. The Chappelle Show.
You've said that way like four times now. I don't understand.
I don't know. It's some habit I got into. I don't know what it was when...
Probably, I don't know.
When you got, you know, Dave wrote...
Isn't saying Chappelle. We both have to work on it, Sam. We're going to talk about it after the show, but we have to stop saying so much.
What people don't realize is that Janine is my mother.
Well, it's getting there. It's getting that way. He says too much, as do I. As do I.
And that's all right.
We'll both work on it.
They can fix it in post. Dave and your partner, one of your executive producers of the Chappelle Show, Neil Brennan, wrote...
Half baked
in
your apartment. Yeah,
it was strange.
Yeah, we went through your stuff.
That's right. And I don't know how I got into the habit of at that point. Maybe it was also with Ben. I don't know, but I don't know why I keep saying that. But you know what I wanted to talk to you about is you have some great stories about some of your sitcom experiences. There was one. every time I say she laughs at me now. Gosh.
Tighten it up, Sam.
I'm tightening it up. So you got some good sitcom stories. I mean, when you were doing Buddies, I was doing another mixed race show, I guess it was. Was it Buddies that you were doing?
Buddies.
And then, so you were developing another show, though, for a different network.
Well, no, Buddies was the first, stinker I did.
Of how many stinkers, would you say?
Well, it's funny you say this, Sam. All right, when I was coming up in pilot development hell, my agent used to always try to make me feel better by saying, Tom Selleck did 7 pilots before he got Magnum. So just hang in there.
Yeah.
So like 8 pilots into it, I was like, okay, this is terrible. But Buddies was like maybe 2 pilots deep. And it was a show that was, completely irrelevant. I knew going in it was irrelevant. It's a long story how it came to be. But it was kind of like walking to the gallows making a show like this.
Oof.
Because you know that it's going to stink.
Right.
And you know you're going to have to go to the barbershop after.
And you get paid so much money.
Well, yeah, but then somehow in that position won't reconcile you just because you had options and you feel like, oh, I chose bad.
Right.
I did this to myself. And, I mean, it was just weird, man. There was no black people writing a show, but it was supposed to be a show about race and da-da-da-da. So from that experience, that's kind of where I learned a lot. But then I thought, that was the first bad experience. So I'm thinking this was just uniquely bad.
Uh-huh.
And so I had 9 or 10 similar experiences and realized...
Somewhere around 8 or 9, you thought there might be something wrong with the system.
Yeah, the network development just... wasn't for me. Now, that being said, I've seen guys who've done great in networks, and I felt like their shows were fair reflections of who they were as comedians, i.e., Ray Romano.
Right.
His show was pretty much his act, and I just didn't think that there was a sitcom conceivable to me that could kind of embody what I wanted to be as a comedian.
It's also a function on some level of, I did a bunch of pilots, and I always contended the reason was because I was just like all the writers out there. You know, you got these Jewish guys coming from the East Coast, and I'm just like them, but with hair. And so it's much easier for me to get a job doing that because they're writing in my cadence, and they're writing basically, I get a lot more guys out there writing, but if you don't see many, there's just not that many black writers out there in Hollywood. It's just not.
They're out there. They're just not getting jobs.
Exactly.
Man. Nobody, I mean, look, for them to say there's just no black writers, it's like, this is too easy and this is the pat answer.
It's the same as the women just aren't funny.
Right.
The women writers just aren't funny. That's why we don't hire them. That's always what you hear. You hear the same thing about anybody who is not white and male. You hear that they're just not out there. They're just not handing in resumes for these writing jobs.
Of course they're out there. And you know, the thing is, it's not like there's quality shows on television. You know, it's not like there's so much good stuff out there. We can't find a room to take a chance on people. It's crap. It's
right.
Crap.
That's not the fault of the writers all the time. It's the fault of the executives who do comedy by committee and water down the product until it's barely watchable.
Well, that's the nature kind of the beast, man. Like, the larger your audience, obviously, the more they're into that, like I said, the least objectionable programming. These guys are just investors, man. They're just investors.
But you know what? They're failing. They're bad investors. I mean, that's the point. No, they, you know, Hollywood has. I mean, they haven't made a decent comedy in years.
Yeah, the stuff they make is pretty terrible. But like with the show, it was one of those things where it was one of those moments in your career where it's like, well, I guess. Look, when I started doing a show on Comedy Central, and I would tell people I'm doing a show on Comedy Central, they looked at me as if they felt bad for me, like, oh,
because
it's a smaller venue, you know. You develop for networking, go make the cable. I was completely cool with it. Because I knew that I was going to get a shot to do something that I've wanted to do for a very long time. You know, like I said, I was working with Neil. I was working with a friend of mine. It's never been better. He knows me. We know each other. It's going to be great. And it turned out to be, you know, by far the most successful thing I've done in that genre.
And it's great. It's great comedy.
Right. And it really just came from them, like, investing in an artist and actually letting him be an artist, for, you know, would be it for corporate ends or whatever. At least I was doing my thing. You
That's
know?
The thing. If they left more people alone, you'd have much better product. And you know, I myself have participated in tons of mediocre products, so I know of what I speak. I have participated in a lot of lame comedy product over my show business experience.
Yeah.
But it's because there are so many levels that one has to go through to get it on the air or to get the movie made, and so many compromises you have to make to what they try and do is please the broadest audiences, and therefore you end up pleasing no one.
See, I have no problem with that attempt to please the broadest audience, but they have no idea what they're doing. They don't know what's going to sell to anybody any more than anything else. If they did, you wouldn't have so many flops. You wouldn't have so many failures. I mean, that's the point, is that it's really... There's a whole system just to justify people's jobs when it doesn't need to be there. It's inserting a series of middlemen or women who really have no sense of what's going to be successful anyways.
No, it's fear. It's fear-based decision-making. It's the same fear-based decision-making that waters down network news and network sitcoms and politics. Everyone is operating from a place of fear, and their highest mandate is don't get fired. So if you're operating from a baseline of don't get fired, you're not going to get a great product. Whereas Dave Chappelle's show could not be done anywhere other than Comedy Central or HBO or Showtime. You couldn't have done it on the network because too many people would have feared getting fired.
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, you know, it is a fear culture. And I also think there's something to be said for the fact that this show had nothing to do with Hollywood per se.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of happened. Like, we developed a show on my farm in Ohio, and then we brought it to the network. You know, we shot it here. Very surprisingly little interference. You know, I mean, when I say they let me go, they let me go. Like, even in retrospect, I can't really think of that many complaints. Like, there were very few arguments relative to what it is to do a network show.
And I think the same stands for a political candidate. Leave him or her alone. That the problem comes with all the second guessing, all of these advisors around them saying, don't say that, that's too controversial, don't do that, back off that, make this statement, and then you get an inferior product at the end of the candidates.
I felt bad for Howard Dean. I never seen some, you know, that whole screen that like made this whole thing fall apart, that was unfair, man.
I was there. That was really unfair. That he did not.
Now you were there. Let me ask you. This is what it looked like was happening to me. You ever do a TV taping or something, and you can't hear yourself in the monitors, so you're talking loud. Crowd is screaming. Ah! So it's like everybody's trying to scream over the crowd. He can't. You know, this is going directly into the camera. His feed is going directly into the camera, so he looks crazy. We're gonna go to da 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 da. But in the room, it probably was perfectly appropriate.
Absolutely. He got Linda McCartney. They only used the feed. Remember when Linda McCartney tape was going around because they would just play her vocals without the music and the band, Wings or what have you? Howard Dean, they only used, deliberately only used the feed going into the camera. They knew that full well, and they never mentioned it. I was at that speech. The music was blasting before he went on. They were playing Kashmir by Led Zeppelin. He comes on. It's very noisy, about 3,000 people in the room, at least 3,000 people having a party. So he is giving a pep talk, like, we're going to go on from Iowa, and we're going to, you know? That's what it was. There's nothing even slightly immoderate about what the man did, nothing crazy. But because he couldn't get waylaid by any scandals, nobody could get him on anything for real, they create the illusion that he's a madman, just like what happened to John McCain when he was threatening to beat Bush for the Republican nomination. They had to create the myth that John McCain is unstable, that he's a madman. And Howard Dean got the same treatment for whatever reason by the corporate media.
Well, there's a lot of reason, I think, that people like that were afraid of Howard Dean, and it was basically because 70% of his money came from average people. Just came through the web, and donations smaller than $2,000, and that scared a lot of people, I think, and it's one of the problems that we have, you know, with our political system in general.
Yeah, he got a raw deal.
And he was a great candidate. And also, there's a lot of things he said that made perfect sense that people try and frame it as crazy. We are not safer now that Saddam has been captured. We are not. That is a fact. When he said it, the mainstream media tried to frame it like it was the craziest thing anyone could ever say.
I mean, but, you know, just like being a comic in this context, I can see, you know, it's that kind of thing where you're standing in front of the crowd and you're like, okay, I could say this, and I'm sure to my sensibility this is funny. But the crowd is just not going to like it. And I think, like you say, for most political candidates, that's their challenge. They're trying to win a crowd over, but at the same time, who wants to hear the truth? Really? Does anybody want to hear the truth? If there was a 24-hour truth network, you would skip over it every time. Because every time you turn to it, it's going to have something you're not going to like. Nobody wants to hear the truth. They say, I want an honest candidate. You don't want that candidate that's going to be like, look, job's bad. I don't know how we're going to get no more jobs, all right? I'm strapped. I'm stressed out. I'm scared. I'm scared, too. You know, you don't want to hear that from a candidate. So they all are, by position, they are forced to lie.
That's true. But but the media sort of leads the witness, if you will, but by telling the public that something that this candidate said is crazy, by telling them that they don't want to hear it. Does that make sense? So if Howard Dean speaks the truth, which he did, the media will pretend that somehow we don't want to hear it, that somehow we thought it was crazy that he said we're not safer. He was trying to help us out. So the media helps him not help us. That doesn't make sense at all, what I just said.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying. Yeah, I'm sure that they freak out. He said we're not any safer. Did you hear what he said? He said we're not any safer. And then at the same time, simultaneous raise terror alert, blah, 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 blah. But at a certain point, man, I'm going to have to start holding the public accountable. Hey, man, media, whatever, God's what the media says, you got two ears, you got two eyes. Some point you're going to have to wait. You can't, you know. And by the way, it's like this polling that everyone is so fond of. I don't know who they're calling.
I know.
Or
asking. If they're actually calling.
Yeah, this is like Family Feud. When Family Feud say we asked 100 people what's the show they like on Thursday, and then the black fans say Steve Harvey. No, I'm sorry, nobody said that. It was Seinfeld's number one answer. You must ask 100 white people. You didn't ask anybody, I know.
It depends on who they're asking and how they're asking the question.
Exactly. Oh, exactly. They always have that weird.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've heard it, America. Wake up. So says Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, I said it.
He says you can't handle the truth.
I said it. You're right. You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to the Majority Report, and you're handling the truth now.
We'll be back soon.
Air America Radio, where no child is left behind for more than a minute or two.
Now more of the Majority Report, evenings 8 to 11 on AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's progressive talk station.
Hello, and we're back with the Majority Report. Sam Cedar, Janine Garofalo, Dave Chappelle. Dave, I want to get into something now that I find is so annoying in politics, is the dishonest use of language. Right now, a biggie is partial birth abortion, which does not exist. There is no such thing as partial birth abortion. There is a dilation and extraction procedure that's used very, very rarely when the mother's life is in danger. And yet, the conservatives trot it out like it's something that's going on all the time as a means to overturn Roe v. Wade. And every time I hear the phrase partial birth abortion, or the phrase death tax, for that matter, which also doesn't exist, it's an inheritance tax. Partial birth abortion, when people say it, what I feel they're saying to me and to anyone who hears it is, we think you're an idiot. We're going to try and con you into thinking there's partial birth abortion going on right now as we speak, all the time, round the clock, that there's these abortionists and feminists and the ACLU running around taking partially born babies and destroying them. Do you get offended at language like death tax and partial birth abortion that are designed to con us into reacting emotionally without thinking?
Yeah, I think that right now that's what most of our culture is about. I think the stuff that they're putting on, what's going on is heavy. And I'm gonna be real, like, this is a guy that's taking it all in with a tailor. Obviously, that's going to be real alarmist. You're going to be real afraid as if something terrible happens all the time. I mean, you know, really, I was in an airport in Boston, man. I got in an argument with the lady behind the desk. I'm not going to say the name of the airline, but the name of our country was in it. Anyway. So the lady, basically what happened was, the plane left me 20 minutes before scheduled departure time after I checked in, after I'd gone through a multitude of security checkpoints. This is in Boston. So I'm arguing with the lady. And she said, well, this is our policy. You have to be in the gate area half an hour before. I said, I can understand it was a law, but unless you post your corporate policy somewhere, how am I expected to know this? So we're arguing back and forth. As we're arguing, people come up to me. Hey, it's Dave Chappelle. Can I get your autograph? Yeah, hold on 1 second. I signed the autograph, but I'm still arguing with the lady. And then the other lady's on the phone, unbeknownst to me, calling airport security. So the guys come out. You know, they got machine guns, which they're coming over. And obviously, I'm looking. And as they're coming, I knew that. I said, okay, these guys must be coming for me. And I told them, I said, I am very offended right now. Suddenly, my tone changed, though. Because they did have machine guns. So I go, you know, I'm really offended right now. And she goes, and she basically tells the guy, she proceeds to tell him, I don't like the way they spoke to me.
So bring out the M16s.
Right. So my whole thing was, listen, we all know what happened at this airport. And I'm still flying out of here. That's a vote of support for you. And this is what I'm getting in return. This is what our culture has become. That now, not only am I taking, I feel like I'm taking risks because terror alert is high, and I'm getting treated worse as a customer because you don't like the way I'm talking to you. I've heard stories where they call the airport security and airports, and the guys run across the airport because a guy on a plane has a knife, and then it'd be like he had a knife, but he was quadriplegic, and you know, this is the weirdest, like, panic-stricken, unreasonable things that are happening as a result of September 11th. And I'm watching all this going on. I'm saying to myself, I don't know if we'll ever go back. I don't know if we'll ever have it the way it was before, you know.
But we could have it if there was more of attention was paid to intellectual discourse and intellectualism in this society. And if it wasn't just moving towards anger and emotion. After 9/11, we had as much unity and as much understanding among people in this nation than we've ever had before. We could have used that to great benefit, and instead it was turned into sort of an Archie Bunker nation with the help of Fox News and the New York Post and all that kind of nonsense. And that's what happens, is what it filters down into what happened to you at the airport. And people, instead of moving to enlightened dialogue between each other to work these things out, it always moves to the most excitable go call security type of situation.
Well, there's
right,
people,
but then you'll hear people like, I love Bill Maher, but then Bill Maher will say, let's be realistic, we have to racially profile Arabs. Now, I mean, as a black man, I can't stand for anybody to be racially profiled, because when you say racial profile, all that means is you're protecting white people. And who is protecting everybody else from white people? If black dudes are pulling out their wallets and getting blown away by these police that are busy protecting white people. And I mean, there's so many, and I could go on and on for days, but it's like, man, look, a brother might steal your wallet. We don't be stealing people and countries and all this stuff. So who's going to protect everybody from white people, man? And so my whole thing is, this culture is, at this point, is disgusting me. When I watch shows about who's the ugliest celebrity, and on the next channel there's a show about I want to look like my favorite celebrity, and then on the next channel there's a, I mean, it's getting to the point where it's like kind of nauseating, and at the same time, and the backdrop of all this is an unprecedented preemptive war. So I don't know, like, what does this mean? What this is an ill, this is an ill context. This is an ill context to be alive. That's all I'm saying. It's an ill. I don't know. It's like, for me, I'm going to be honest with you, I've never voted in my life. I know that people have died for me to have the right to vote. I appreciate my right to vote, but it really never seemed, personally, that important to me. You know, I have my beliefs about that. This year I'm going to vote. This year is my first time coming out to the polls after I've seen a dead even election and just a lot of wild things happened since that election. I said, you know what, just in case voting is important, this is now is the time to participate. As a guy that's voting for the first time, I gotta say that I'm voting for one of these guys, obviously, but none of these guys really stir anything in me at all.
Well,
I'm just being real.
Well,
at this point,
we appreciate it.
The point is to vote.
This is NASA Truth Network. Nobody's moving me, man. Even when I hear people talking about, you know, Bush sent us to war. Look, man, when the Congress was voting for it, I didn't see nobody voting their conscience. I saw them thinking about re-election. It was the sister from California. She voted her conscience, but I ain't seen nobody else. I think it was overwhelmingly.
Well, Dennis Kucinich was out there, you know.
And a small minority. Mm-hmm. There were people that had the balls to vote their conscience. And by balls, I mean round rubber balls so they went out in trouble with the FCC. But, you know, I'm just saying that ultimately, man, you know, as a guy that's watching all this from his living room, I cannot help but feel very cynical about what's going on. That's all I'm saying.
It's tough not to.
It's hard to believe anybody right now.
Well, one thing I just want to say is that the lesser of two evils is less evil.
Yeah, I'm down for that, and that's why I say I'm voting this year. But why can't we have a good candidate? I'm tired of voting for the lesser evil. Why can't we have somebody that actually believes what he's talking about? Ralph Nader had reparations for slavery in his platform, and that made me not believe him. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm like, I'm just torn. So, you know, I'm not trying to dissuade anyone from voting. I'm just saying that to sum it all up, I have never been more disgusted and confused about what's going on in my life. That's why I'm going to participate this year, and it's just, I'm disheartened.
Well, wake up, citizens. That's the message from tonight. Go out there and vote. Dave, thank you so much for coming in.
No, no problem. Listen, man, I'm glad you guys are here, man. I say it all the time every time I see Janine. I think you're the bravest person in show business. I love what you do. Keep doing what you're doing, man. And I just like, no, because Janine is so crazy that she believes things. and I loved it.
Thank you so much for coming in.
All right, God wanted you to have a radio show. I'm out.
Thank you.
We're taking a short break, but we still have successful business entrepreneur and activist Ben Cohen yet to come. He'll be right back with us. You're listening to Majority Report on Air American Radio. Thank you very much.
Air America Radio. The last word in edgewise.
You're back on the Majority Report. Is that our demo? The easy listening album sold at Borders? Is that our demo? Which is not to suggest that we shouldn't have advertisers, because I know
our demo is going to go out and buy that stuff, and I don't know what they're going to do with it. Maybe they can give it to their parents. I wanted to, before we get our next guest, I wanted to make a brief announcement that all you web surfers and blogospherites out there might enjoy dropping by Majority Report Radio to give us some comments on what you thought on the show. And, of course, you can visit our official website at airamericaradio.com. Next up, Janine.
We are lucky enough to be with Ben Cohen, who is one of the co-founders of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. But as importantly, if not more importantly, in these troubled times, he is a social justice activist. He is the founder of TrueMajority.org and Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Gene, I'm honored to be on your show, man. This is a historic event.
Thank you, and I am very, very pleased so far to have had you, Bill Maher, Dave Chappelle, and Atrios. It's been a real honor for us.
I'm in incredible company. I'm totally honored. There's a lot of honoring going on around here.
So let's just go from the base of honor as our point of origin and move on from there.
I just want to move on. I like that. Good plug. That's the other organization. But,
MoveOn.org.
Right.
That former Enron lobbyist Ed Gillespie is always and Republican National Committee or Council, RNC head Ed Gillespie is always trying to shut down MoveOn.org.
That's, you know, I wish they would try to shut down True Majority.
Ooh, your voice just cut out. Ben, can you hear us? Ed Gillespie just...
Oh, wait a minute.
There you are. There he is.
I'm back. All right.
So why don't you... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mostly wanted to say that I'm totally down with what Dave Chappelle was saying. You know, I mean, I think the name of the game is anybody but Bush. And, I mean, I endorsed Kucinich, but I always said it was anybody but Bush, and I'm down with that.
It's a pretty unprecedented year for Democratic unity, don't you think?
You know, what amazes me is that, you know, the statistic that, you know, in the last election, 2000, that, you know, only one out of every two Sierra Club members voted and only one out of every two League of Conservation voters and, you know, and a whole bunch of organizations.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities. You took a full-page ad out recently in the New York Times.
Yes, we did. We likened. We had a photo of a bunch of CEOs being led away in handcuffs, and suggested that that's what happens to CEOs who lie, and you know, the president ought to be held accountable for his lies.
Why do you think it is that the Bush administration feels that they operate under the theme of accountability last, if ever?
I think, you know, I mean, you know, I was in business for 20 years or so, and, you know, I found that, you know, most business people are, you know, good, honest, straight people. And then every once in a while, you run into these guys that somehow make their way to the top that just believe that it's them versus everybody else, and the name of the game is to, you know, take care of number one, and, you know.
But if you look at the business section of the New York Times every day, it looks like a police blotter. So
it's true. It's amazing.
Is this something new, or is it just that we're talking?
No,
about
it? I think this is. Well, I think it's been going on. I think it's been getting worse. I think it's probably been getting worse as CEO pay has gone up. I think that you tend to attract extremely greedy, ruthless people. You know, that doesn't go for all of them. You know, I know a bunch of them. Some of my own members. You know who, you know. Care and are trying to do the right thing and, you know, are with us. But there's some that aren't. That's all I'm saying.
Now, don't you think
there's... But what amazed me was that I became able to understand, I think, what's going on with the Bush administration much better than I would have before I understood the mentality of, you know, that particular type of corporate greedy mentality.
there's a profiteerist quality to it. I mean, maybe I'm taking a little bit of liberties with the notion of capitalism, but part of it is reinvestment and this notion that you put it back into the business or the endeavor that you're doing.
Well, capitalism is all about capital, and he who has the equity, gets further and further ahead. I mean, what's that statistic on how much the top 10 or 20% of the population owns in terms of the wealth of the country? I mean, it's like 80%.
And the gap is widening. The gap is widening by leaps and bounds. And, you know, one of the things I just mentioned to Dave Chappelle when he was just on here is about dishonest language, like the death tax. There is no such thing as a death tax. There is an inheritance tax.
That's right. That applies to, again, the top 10 or 20% of the population.
Exactly. Yet when he was campaigning, Bush kept saying to eliminate the death tax was to help the small family farmer. That is a complete lie.
Right. Right.
There is no small family farmers anymore.
I admire these guys as unscrupulous communicators. They do an excellent job of it. They are great disinformation propaganda style guys.
Well, like a phrase like partial birth abortion. It doesn't exist. They managed to outlaw a fictional...
You know, Rove is just a good marketer. I take that back. He's an excellent marketer. he looks at the product he's trying to sell, opposition to abortion and
opposition to women's reproductive rights. That's what it is. It's hostile.
He wants to paint it as right. How bad can I possibly paint these guys? I could throw out in front of my guys?
How can you have? I'm sorry to interrupt here, but this is what really I get passionate about. This. How can you have a pro-life, pro-gun, pro-war, pro-death penalty Christian? It's illogical.
I agree with you. I agree with you. I definitely agree with you. I think if you look at what Jesus said, it's not. You can't do it. It's not. That's not what he was preaching.
He wasn't talking about sort of intimidation and
privatization.
he was talking. I mean, my understanding is that there's this Sermon on the Mount, and this is not my religion, but I understand that he was talking about taking care of those disadvantaged among us, of the least among us.
So that would go in keeping with Bush trying to cut child care funds for the poor. And the Senate defied him.
You look anywhere, child care funds for the poor, dismantling Head Start. What's the other thing that I saw recently?
I'm sure it's something
the
that would have benefited
on.
The
people.
There's heating assistance for low-income people.
Not anymore.
Here in Vermont, man. It's like minus 20, and these older people are forced to decide between food and heat.
Well, Karl Rove
says...
And
he reduced the program.
Karl Rove says we just need to win the South. That's one of the things that everything I read about, even coming from conservatives, is that Paul O'Neill wrote this, Clark says it, that never has there been a White House that has been so devoid of policy people that the political hacks make all the policy decisions just by sticking their finger up and seeing which way the ultra-Christian right is blowing.
Which way the cracker blows. That's what they're saying strategy.
What amazes me, and this is what I think Dave and myself are saying, is that if they are so successful playing to the hardcore extreme of their constituency, why the hell are we not playing to the hardcore extreme of our constituency?
Well, we don't have enough assistance. You know, they have, you know... We don't have... First of all, it's very easy for the Bush administration to reach their quote-unquote base. They've got it all sewn up. They've got all the money. They've got the media backing them. They have everything in place to get the message out, as it were. And, you know, to call Karl Rove a genius in this is, I think, odd. What is so genius about tapping into people's inner Archie Bunker? What is genius about that? Seducing people's lesser nature.
Well,
it's easy.
He identifies it as the strategy, and he tactically executes it really, really well. I mean, you know, the guy is, I think, really good at what he does.
Well, we'll talk more about whether or not the Democrats should play harder to their base when we come back. We're talking to Ben Cohen.
TrueMajority.org and Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities.
And you're listening to the Majority Report.
Air America Radio. Radio this fun can't be good for you.
Welcome back to the Majority Report here on Air America Radio. I'm Janine Garofalo with Sam Cedar, and we have on the phone Ben Cohen of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream of TrueMajority.org and Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities. Ben, why don't we go right into why you're so passionate about e-voting?
Oh, geez. You know, that's so incredible that, you know, we essentially have e-vote machines existing, which are kind of like the ATM machines that we all use. And, you know, they're touch screen.
Oh, we lost you.
Well, the guys from Diebold.
The touch screen voting, Joe. They are all around. I think it has part to do with the OnStar.
Is my telemetry or yours? Anyhow, you know, we use these touch screen voting machines to do something as serious as move money around, you know, hundreds of dollars. And, you know, every time you do a transaction, you get a receipt. And it would have been so easy to use that technology for voting machines. And instead, they came up with this system that doesn't put out a receipt. So you essentially do this transaction by pressing some touch screens, and you don't know whether the machine recorded what you touched.
And there's no paper trail.
There's zero paper trail. It makes it impossible to have a recount. I mean, I don't understand why it's not illegal on that basis. I mean, I thought that votes had to be recountable. I mean, the people that are supporting this are saying that, well, because there's no paper trail, you can never prove that the machine made a mistake or that it was manipulated or tampered with or whatever. There's nothing to recount it against.
Now, there's a story about...
It must be right.
There's a story about the guy who made these machines, right? The guy who runs Diebold, is that what it is?
He's a real partisan, a real Republican partisan.
He's one of these, like, Republican pioneers, and he says, he made the statement, I'm going to deliver whatever state it was.
Ohio.
Ohio.
Here's a guy writing a letter to the president, assuring him that he's going to deliver Ohio, and he's in charge of making voting machines that are impossible to validate the votes. I mean, that is, it's absurd.
But what's so crazy about it is the technology to do it exists, and it's so simple. I mean, there's no reason not to do it.
They must have spent more money in making these machines not to spit out paper than it would have just to adapt some ATM.
Absolutely right. Well, if you bid on both types of machines, they come in at the same price, essentially.
Unbelievable. Well, Ben, listen, we're running out of time, so we want to thank you very much. We
and you are coming
you back.
You are coming back as a regular.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be here with you guys.
We've been talking to Ben Cohen, co-founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream and the founder of TrueMajority.org. Ben, thank you for being with us on the first edition of the Majority Report.
All right, well, congratulations, you guys, and keep up the great work.
And please, you're welcome here anytime.
All righty. I'll bring ice cream next time.
Ooh,
thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
So, Janine, we are nearing the end of our inaugural show. I feel like we have been uniters, not dividers.
Right.
And I feel like we haven't been obsessed from the beginning of our inauguration with going to Iraq, you know, revenging some plot to kill our fathers.
No, but what we will do is work on saying We both do it too much. We both tend to ramble a little bit, and I want to say to the audience who has noticed it and perhaps is as annoyed with it as I am with myself, We are going to work on it. I'm going to work on tightening it up. It's just first night rambling sometimes. I'm not saying we do it all the time.
We'll do it on the second night. We'll do it on the third night. By the fourth night, perhaps, it'll be a little bit
and
less.
And what casual, that would be casual what?
Casual Monday. Yeah?
Where everyone will be wearing, actually, Monday is 50s day.
Monday's 50s day, which means...
poodle skirts and segregation.
That's right. No more waiting at the bubbler. We get right in line as we are white.
Separate but equal bubblers.
All right, well, we want to thank our guests for tonight. Bill Maher.
Dave Chappelle. Ben Cohen. Atrios.
From the blogosphere. And
tell again about our blog.
Oh, well, for more information about the Majority Report and Air America Radio, go to our website, airamericaradio.com. Send us an email. If you want to post an immediate comment during tomorrow night's show, go to MajorityPartRadio.com. That's our little blog area. And if you missed the O'Franken Factor this afternoon, which was awesome, you got to stay tuned after the news. The show's going to repeat. It's our inaugural show on our inaugural day.
Thank you so much for being with us, everybody. We really look forward to forming a great relationship. Permanently.
Tomorrow night, we're going to have Congressman Barney Frank. We're going to have writer David Korn from The Nation. And more. Much, much more.
Good night.
On The Majority Report. Air America Radio.
Well, that was that. That was then. Now is now. I listened to most of that show. The Chappelle interview was actually very interesting. Some of the rest of it was a little bit depressing because we haven't made the progress we wanted to make. And then there was also the part where I was almost traumatized by how Janine was already starting to bully me. Folks, we'll be back on Monday. I'll be back on Monday. Hopefully Evan and Dorsey will be here. And the office is coming along nicely. Maybe we'll make a little video. And everybody can take a look at it. All right, have a good weekend. We'll see you on Monday.